I was all set up to record this cheery, like, hey, subscribe to our Patreon because blah, blah, blah. And then fucking Schoology. I got another email from Schoology. This is not an advertisement from Schoology. I actually sort of hate them about missed assignments. So instead, you're going to get the real me. Hi. I have a lot of exciting episodes coming out on Patreon. For just $5, you can get tips on how to stay sane during college application for you and your kid, expert advice on growing your band from a pretty badass media strategist, an explanation of the controversy of DNA and whether the use of it to solve crimes is actually an invasion of privacy. A closer look at New York's epilepsy colony that really lasted much longer than it should have. Think like 70s, 80s, as in 1970s and 80s, where treatment meant actually you're just stuck here for the rest of your life. And also an early release of a two-part episode where I speak to a psychologist who only learned that her husband was leading a double life when he turned up dead. So, subscribe to the Patreon at the $5 level if you want to hear any of these episodes. Thanks for listening. Text me if you hate Schoology as much as I do. Ugh.
My name is Dr. Lindsay Weisner. I'm a psychologist, author, a mom, and still an occasional shit show. You're listening to the Neurotic Nourishment Podcast. This is a place for smart, sweary women to talk about stuff that matters, stuff that can make us uncomfortable, but stuff that helps us to learn and grow and be okay with living in that discomfort of not knowing the right thing to say or do all the time. Thanks for listening. You can also find me on Instagram at PsychShrinkMom or at Neurotic Nourishment.
There we go.
I hate her voice. I was just gonna say, I don't trust the cloud yet, so I'm moving into it, but this recording is on my computer because it's super important. And then, of course, and then worst comes to worst, something goes wrong. I don't know. Nothing's gonna go wrong.
I feel it. I back up everything that I do. I do these recordings, and then once a week I put everything on an external and on the cloud because I'm paranoid about that too.
Well, last summer, three computers blew.
Wow.
And it just happened to be I married a man who is neurotic, more neurotic than I, and backs shit up regularly on those like sticky USB drive, whatever they're called. And so thank God, because otherwise I think I just would have given up on it, like my life, and been like, I'm not starting fresh. I give up. So I am here with Jay Schiffman of the Choose Your Struggle podcast. Of so very many things. I don't even know. I do because I have all your links already in a Google Doc to pull up. But one of my favorite things about Jay, and one of the real, well, he's a storyteller, he's a speaker, he's a coach, he's a mental health advocate. And I'm buying a shirt of that hat that he's wearing because it says fuck stigma. Although I would just use the U instead of the star, but
I would too, but you know, the thing that makes a lot of people feel like it's okay to wear this is the star. So that's how I get around that and sell it to yoga moms who aren't comfortable with the whole phrase.
Fun fact, I am actually technically a yoga mom. I did my yoga teacher training twice during COVID.
Wow, twice. That's
well,
impressive.
The first one sucked. The second one was much better. But so... technically, I am a yoga mom. And
well, you're ruining it for everybody else. You're setting a very high bar.
I do that for a lot of people. What can I say? I think my husband's gonna lose his shit because of my second podcast that I just started. He's like, this is getting fancy. Choose Your Struggle is the name of your podcast. There's so much to you, and there's so much to say, and
happy to report my Costco order is arriving shortly, but it doesn't matter. I'm going to start with the obvious. What does Choose Your Struggle mean?
Yeah, so Choose Your Struggle is the name of my company. It's the name of my podcast. It's my hashtag. I own the trademark. It's my brand.
Were you worried I was going to steal it? Because,
I've been very lucky, surprisingly, with how prevalent, if you search for like Choose Your Struggle on things like TikTok and Instagram, you get a lot. But no one has yet used it as a thing the way I have. Like, it's just one of those motivational hashtags, whatever. So that's why I was very quick last year to go ahead and get the trademarks. I'm like, it amazes me that nobody has done this yet. So I'm going to go ahead and get it just in case other people are thinking about it. But it was born in 2015 when I told my story on stage for the first time, which was election night, actually, of 2015. And I told my story of struggling with substance misuse, my mental health, all that kind of stuff. And what it comes from is I'm a guy who was born into pretty incredible privilege, both as a white male in this world, but also, or I should say a white American male in the US, and also as a person that comes from means. And because of that, I really never had to struggle in terms of having things forced upon me, right? I never had to worry about where the next meal was going to come from, or if I was going to have a roof over my head. And so because of that, I had the unbelievable privilege of being able to choose what I was going to struggle for in life. And then when I got to my worst, 2008, 2009, my struggles were being chosen for me, and that was to avoid withdrawals. I was at a point where if I didn't start taking handfuls of medication, of pills, the minute I woke up, like literally took my first breath and reached for my pill bottle, right? If I didn't do that, I would start going into withdrawal and spend the morning wrapped around my toilet. And just to get off the couch and be a person every day. Those were my struggles. I didn't choose that.
Hold on, I want to slow you down because your addiction was to painkillers?
No, I was on one painkiller, but when I talk about it, I really focus on the benzodiazepines and antipsychotics. So clonazepam, K-pins, as we
clonopin, benzos, yep. Yeah.
Yes, and also ADHD medication. So at the time for me that was Concerta. So those were my issues. I was on 6 different medications a day. 4 of them were benzos and antipsychotics. 1 was a painkiller and 1 was that ADHD medication.
I really want to unpack how that all came about, if that's okay.
Of course. So I was diagnosed with ADHD in the late 90s.
And you mean when everyone was that?
That is literally my follow-up point to that. So I actually have the statistics. And when I was born in the mid 80s, that number of people who were treated every year for ADHD, this umbrella, which includes ADD and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
That number was roughly 300,000 kids in the United States. By the time I was diagnosed in the late 90s, that had exploded to just under 2 million. So in a decade.
I'm so happy you have those stats. Yeah.
I do. Do you want to guess how many it is today?
No.
So I give this talk, I drop that knowledge on stage, and I used to not include what it was today. And one time this woman comes up to me afterwards and she goes, "Oh my God, that's so horrible what they were doing to your generation. At least we don't do that anymore." And I was like, "I am so sorry to be the one to tell you this. That number is approaching 5 million now."
Wow.
Yeah, so if we thought it was bad going from 300,000 to 2 million, in the 20 years since, it has gone from 2 million to almost 5 million. So this is still a rapidly growing problem. And by the way, I want to make this very clear because I always try to do this. I am not anti-medication. What I am anti is thinking that 5 million young people in this country need that medication.
100%. And I'm going to jump in here because this is something that I talk openly about, and, you know, and it is sort of funny. We have known, my husband and I are both psychologists. We have known since like the age of my son was 5 that he had ADHD, not hyper. So this isn't like the kid's not listening. And I feel like that's a distinction. This is like, I tell him to get dressed 5 times. I walk into his room. He's got on a shirt, a shoe.
One sock.
One sock. And like underwear, you know, like it's something like that where you're like, okay. And so I always thought we're just going to wait till, I work with teenagers, you know, as a psychologist. And, I thought being, we're just going to wait until high school and we'll get him on meds or, you know, because then he has this diagnosis for SATs for whatever. And then, when he was in the fifth grade, they decided to prepare them for middle school, which prepares them for high school by having them change classrooms. And so this was too much for my kid. And so, you know, he got very depressed, very anxious. We put him in therapy. And then when it didn't get better, we had him assessed for, you know, ADHD. It was a no-brainer. He started meds. But the thing is, when I was filling out his stuff, I was like, this is weird. Because I was born in 77. And so I made an appointment to see a neurologist. And I was like, this is going to sound fucking crazy. You know, I'm a doctor. I'm 40. I'm, you know, is it possible? And I explained the whole story to him. And he goes, well, did you procrastinate in school? I was like, no. He goes, never? Like, not in any reason? I was like, no. Oh. I was like, oh, yeah. See, I can't procrastinate because I can only pay attention to something for so long. Mm-hmm. And so I have to start studying weeks in advance. And then we both went, oh, okay. And so in my case, in my son's case, you can see a difference where if he doesn't take his meds, he'll sit there and go, woo, woo, you know, it's like, Hunter, shut the fuck up. Like, but I wasn't diagnosed because girls didn't have it. And quiet girls who put glue on their hands and watched it dry and peeled it off certainly weren't disturbing anyone, you know? But I agree 100%, 100,000%. We over-medicate often, you know? And so I can totally see it. So I agree it is a problem and also a real thing, yeah.
And I was the opposite of you. I was the kid who was more concerned with making his classmates laugh. I wasn't the quiet guy sitting there just not paying attention. I was the one not paying attention, but trying to entertain everybody else because I figured that everybody else was just as bored as I was. So I was very much a clear cut case. Here is the thing, right? When people hear me say that, they think, oh, you know, he's in. No. That one made sense. I also was diagnosed with OCD and anxiety and depression. All of that made sense.
Well, because it goes together.
All of it does.
Yeah.
Right. Here's where it became an issue. So I get all these diagnoses as a preteen, right? Now, think about what else is happening around that age. Puberty. We all remember how much fun that was.
So much.
And your body is going through these drastic changes. So you have a guy who has all of these struggles going on. You also are going through puberty. And so your body, your mind, everything is going haywire. And then you add on top of that substantial level of chemicals, right? Yeah. So looking back, it's very easy to go, oh, that's going to be a perfect storm of shit for this preteen, right? Mm-hmm. Unfortunately for me, my therapist does not see this perfect storm that he helped create by adding medication on top of this. He sees signs of a bigger issue, which he decides to give a name a couple years later. That name he gives is bipolar disorder. So now, again, I want to make this very clear. Bipolar disorder is a very real thing. There are a lot of people who struggle with it. I did not. I had a lot of competing factors here, one of which was that I was medicated from the time that I was 11 until the time that I was 23.
Yeah.
So by my late teens, I'm now being treated for this diagnosis of bipolar disorder as well as my ADHD. So yeah, so
I'm sorry.
No, you're good. So I'm trying to pick up like where's the thread. Basically, what I'm trying to get to here is that by my late teens, I am on a exceedingly high count of medications and
also
high level.
Conflicting. You don't give benzos. I mean, actually, I have a Klonopin and prescription that if I need to sleep at night, or anxiety. But you don't daily give this conflicting uppers and downers to someone. And it's
sure.
Also, the brain doesn't fully develop like until 20, 25, 26 in men. So they're treating something that might have fix itself or not. You don't know.
Well, yeah, so that's the thing is that a lot of these symptoms, when I did stop taking medication, a lot of them disappeared with the medication, and a lot of other ones just receded as I got older and my brain developed.
Right. Did you have bipolar 1 or bipolar 2?
I was given a diagnosis of bipolar 2.
Okay, which I think is also a bullshit diagnosis. Some people have it, but it's kind of like, it's like some days I'm happy, some days I'm sad, you know? And I fucking wish we would remove that diagnosis.
So I will say the one part of that that is spot on is that I am a very emotional person, you know, and this is something my wife has learned to live with, that you know, and that can be very positive too, right? I mean, I am very loving and all of that. And it also means that I'm, you know, get sad and all of this. But just because my emotions are very strong, I don't think means that there's something wrong with me.
No, it means that you're fucking human.
So I have my first real depressive episode when I am a freshman in college. And I end up transferring schools back to my hometown. I'm living somewhere else. And by this point, I am becoming physically and mentally dependent on my medications. Now, again, the hindsight being 2020, I know now I was being taught whenever I had a strong emotion, the answer was pop pills.
Right.
So the dependence part was there, but the knowledge was also being instituted in me that there's something wrong with this. This is what I'm supposed to be doing, is to mellow or sort of, if I'm here, it's just to bring myself to here. So by 22, I am completely addicted to multiple medications, including Klonopin. K-pins were my biggest struggle.
How do you know? So, okay, to me, explain a Klonopin addiction.
Yeah. So just sort of visually, the way I describe it is, if you've ever seen the show House, the way he is with his Vicodin, that was me with Klonopin.
Yeah.
Oh, I loved it. I'm a huge Hugh Lowry fan.
Yeah.
But you know, he famously on that show carries around a bottle of Vicodin that he just pops throughout the day.
Right.
That was me on Klonopin, except instead of one, it was like, I sort of ate them like mini M&Ms. I would just pop them back.
Your tolerance goes,
My tolerance was through the roof.
Yeah.
I got to the point by age 22 at the time, I don't know if this is still the case, they thought the lethal dosage was, I think, if I remember this, it was like 17 or 18 Klonopin a day. I was on over that. I was taking upwards of 20 pills a day, just handfuls at a time.
Yeah, I mean, we're humans. We adapt. I mean, having a legal limit is sort of ridiculous, you know. I mean, useful, but not usable. When you're a pro, when you're good at something, you're good at something.
I was very good at taking pills. I got to the point, I say this, when I first got on ADHD medication as a preteen, my mother had to hide my pill in a banana so that I could get it down my throat. By the time I'm in 22, I'm taking 10, 12 pills at a time without water, just knocking them back.
Right.
So I was a pro at swallowing pills.
And it's too bad this wasn't an Olympic sport.
Like, I would have been a gold medalist 8 times over. I would have been the most popular in the world.
Better than rhythmic gymnastics. It's still pretty fucking good, I have to tell you.
So, but the issue is I'm not just on Klonopin, right? I mean, my list is long of things they tried me on. And as you know, unfortunately, with some people in your industry who are not good at what they do, unlike you, I'm sure.
I also don't prescribe.
Well, you know what? Here's the thing. My therapist didn't either, who's a psychologist, not a psychiatrist. But I would come into his office. We would talk about how I was feeling, which in the last couple of years was increasingly more erratic and worse. He would send me down the hall to the psychiatrist with instructions of what to tell him I needed from my psychologist. So I didn't question it.
I forget we're audio because I just did a huge eye roll and I just wanted to,
So I mean, I didn't question this. He said I needed it. And so I said, okay. And the answer was never, well, maybe pills aren't the answer, or maybe we should try other things. It was always either more of something or adding something on. So again, by the time I'm 22, I'm on 5 or 6 different things every day and trying new things. Okay, that didn't work. Let's try this one, or let's go up this amount, whatever. So I'm getting worse and worse. I mean, I at this point, I am not healthy. My thinking is not clear. I am I'm erratic emotionally. It's all over the place. And again, the answer to me at the time wasn't, you know, maybe I should dial this down a little bit. It was take more pills.
Well, because so, it's not for you to, I mean, you're putting, first of all, you must be a very good patient, bad outcome, but good patient, because no one listens to jack shit I say. And when, when someone actually needs, like, you know, medication for depression or anxiety, like, it usually takes me 6 months to talk them into it. That being said, I only send them to psychiatrists who believe in the 1 year rule, where, like, get stable in 1 year, we decrease, you know.
That was not my therapist. In fact, it was the opposite. It got to the point where I was taking so much. I was taking a month's worth in about 12 days. And, you know, as you know, when that's the case, the pharmacy has to call in approval to refill this.
Yeah.
And he was giving his approval. So he knew. I mean, there's no way around this, right? He knew that I was so dependent on this that I was running through my prescription in less than 2 weeks. It was supposed to last me a month. So that's when things got really bad. I like to tell this story because I think it should have been my red flag. I went to the Middle East with a bunch of friends in the winter of 2008. And I'm going through JFK. And I get pulled out of line by security and searched, like physically searched, because I'm carrying a backpack. The only thing in it are like 10 pill bottles. I know, no, it's hilarious to me, right? And they literally said to me, "We do not believe you are not a drug dealer." That was what they said.
I do not blame them.
Yeah, right. And it also doesn't help my case that the backpack is a jawstring backpack with Bob Marley's face on one side and a pot leaf on the other.
Right.
I'm a full-on hippie. I mean, I have a beard down to my chest and, you know, a big afro. I mean, I was a walking billboard for drugs. And so I should have taken that as a red flag. Obviously, I was just like, no, like, look, all my names are on them. The same, you know, therapist is on them. So they eventually let me go. And it's a funny story, but it was also like, come on, man. How did you not realize this is a problem?
Because you had, technically at the time, everything you were doing was legal.
Yes,
I don't know about the pot, but whatever. But, you know, that's a different story. But, like, at the time, everything in that moment was by the books. There was an expert telling you this was okay.
Yeah, I mean, that was the problem, right?
I know.
My dealers were Walgreens and CVS. So
excellent line, yeah.
So, and what's so great about that, by the way, is I didn't have to get out of my car. I went through a drive-thru, I handed my insurance card, and they gave me pills. It was amazing. So by that spring, I am completely at the depths of this struggle. I'm like, I'm not in school anymore because I failed out. I quit my job because I just, like, could not focus. I'm so all over the place. I'm barely getting out of bed. And if I do, you know, I'm just going to hang out with friends. Like, I'm really not doing a whole lot. And that summer of 2009, I spent the summer following this band around the country. They went to music festivals. I went to these music festivals. I lived out of my car, just going from different place to place to see them perform. And what was so amazing about that and why that's so important is that I was at a place where I could not function in society anymore, but I went to these music festivals and I fit in, right? I mean, everybody there is different. Everybody there looks like me. Everyone there is taking mass loads of drugs. I fit in with everybody. And that ended up being a problem because I came back from that experience and had this realization of, oh, I fit there. I do not fit in here. And the biggest part of that problem was I had been told now for about half a decade that I had this very serious issue of mental health. Bipolar disorder is a very real diagnosis. And not only was I not getting better on the drugs that were supposed to make me better, I was getting worse. And so I internalized this and thought, wow, the problem must be with me. I must be unfixable. And I lost hope. And that's when I decided to commit suicide. So do you want me to tell this? Do you want me to get into this? Or
I do, if you don't mind. I
of
also
course.
Want to point out that, I want to ask a question because there's been this. It pisses me off when people say that we shouldn't use the word commit suicide, and that naturally flowed out of your mouth. And so I'm curious about your, also because I know substance use versus substance misuse is one of your things. So I want to hear the story, but I also real quickly want to hear just what do you think about the commit word? Because I struggle, and it still comes more naturally to me. And yet I understand people have lost someone, like a mom who's lost a son. But so I'm not calling you out on it. I'm wondering if you feel similarly to how I do, or if it just, you know.
I'm with you. I 100% understand the feeling behind, let's stop saying commit, because words being important is one of my big things, as you said, trying to get rid of the word substance abuse and replace it with substance misuse, and not saying the word clean anymore are like two of my biggest pushes. So it would be disingenuous for me to be like, nah, but I don't agree with that one. However, I'm with you. I'm still working on it. I'm not there yet. And commit still comes out of my mouth. As you and I started talking before we got on this, about my big story that I just told and put on my podcast this week about stopping somebody, I use the word commit throughout. I have had someone say to me before, you know, we're really trying to get away from that. I hear you. I'm with you. I am still working on it, as you can tell. But I also believe that
it's an action.
It is. If I'll say it this way. Because just because it doesn't 100% make sense to me, again, as somebody who has attempted and lived through suicide, as somebody who, you know, has stopped other people from attempting suicide, if there are people that feel that way, even if that doesn't make sense to me, I hear you. And if that is something that is upsetting to you, I want to be accommodating to that.
Right. It doesn't upset,
is my feeling.
Let me be clear. It doesn't upset me. It actually upsets me that it upsets other people, because if it were my child, I would probably possibly feel the same way. Mm-hmm. But as the child of someone who repeatedly attempts to commit suicide, I think there needs to be some accountability, but it doesn't go, but that's my shit, you know, and I recognize that. So that's why I just needed to know.
No, I agree with you. And, you know, I think, again, words are very important. And I want to hear from you if you are one of those people who thinks we need to get away from commit and saying attempt or complete. I would love to hear your thinking behind this. I am not a closed book on that at all.
Neither am I. But on this one, I feel it distracts from the main
course. So that argument I do 100% buy into, because I've had someone say to me before, okay, but when you're fighting other people about the words clean and substance abuse or its misuse, it takes away from the bigger problems. And my response to that is, number one, you're right. Number two, sometimes words can have a bigger impact than we think. And the word, I'll tell you, the reason I fight for those two so heavily, number one, clean, comes from calling drug users dirty. That's pretty egregious. Let's just get rid of it. Substance abuse versus misuse. Substance abuse is a made-up term that came from the war on drugs, trying to equate using drugs with, you know, spousal abuse, child abuse, all these really heinous acts.
I read about this or heard about this on your pod, yes. And it was amazing. Yeah.
So that, when you hear that and you go, oh, wow, okay, we should stop using that, because clearly me smoking a joint is not the same as fondling a child. Like, that's pretty horrible when you think about that.
I guess it depends how you smoke the joint, but hopefully.
All right, fair. Never have I smoked a joint in a way that has been as harmful to somebody as that. So in that respect, getting away from that term that was made up to demonize people like me, okay, like that's important. The commit one, I understand the rationale. However, I tend to side with you where it's like, all right, but if this is how people hear this, like, we need to keep talking about this subject. However, again, if you do feel strongly about this, please reach out and tell me why you do, and maybe I'll change my mind. I think this is an important debate.
I don't know if I will change my mind, but I do empathize and I do feel awful. But I do want to hear the story of your attempt to commit suicide, and I hope I don't come off as insensitive.
No. It doesn't. You haven't to me. That's not one that upsets me.
That's all that matters, you know.
My struggle with this starts. It was two nights in a row. Like I said, I'd given up hope. I decided that there was that I was the problem. I was not going to get better, and so I dumped out on my computer. And I still have, obviously, this image in my head of on this, you know, dirty couch I was basically living on. I dump out what I think is probably a lethal dosage, and I call a good friend of mine and I tell her what I'm going to do. She keeps me talking while she texts some friends of ours who rush over and stop me. And as I love to joke, this could have been the end of it. You know, if this was a movie, this is where I throw up my hands and say, I'm going to find Jesus or whatever the hell, you know, that movie would be about. However, all I learned that night was, okay, tomorrow I need to take the drugs first and then call her, which I do. And this time, because I've taken the drugs first, she does what, you know, you're supposed to do. She calls 911. Unfortunately, because we live in the United States, what that meant was a cop showed up at my door. And I was let out of my house in handcuffs, and I was thrown against the side of a cop car, and then my head was shoved into the back seat, and that is my last memory before I black out. So, luckily for me, this cop took me straight to the hospital. Clearly, he did not care if I lived or died, but he did take me to the hospital, and I spent the night handcuffed to a bed in the emergency room.
Where were you living at that time? Because the response that this cop had to you is different than the response that I've seen this cop have in my many, many viewings of this.
So this was Cincinnati, Ohio. However, again, this was 2009. And I've been told by officers that is not the case anymore. I would hope that to be true. However, as someone who strongly believes in funding other sources of emergency response besides just police officers, I think my story is informative in that respect of, I wish we had started this conversation 20 years ago instead of now, because I am lucky that that cop took me straight to the hospital. Again, his actions suggest that my survival was not the highest on his list at the moment.
Agreed. But I'm curious if it was, were you, this, I'm not justifying, I'm placing it. Were you living... You know, were you still looking like a hippie living in a shithole?
No, I was in a house in the three blocks from the university. This was very much what I can only assume is a cop whose beat was mostly stupid early 21-year-old, you know, university kids, and he just did not care. You know, this is not why he got into policing, was to tell kids to turn their stereos down and break up parties. And just did not give a fuck. That's my assumption.
Right. I mean, I absolutely think, you know, a wealthy white woman gets treated a lot differently in the same situation.
Yeah. And look, I was living, it was a drug house. I mean, I had 11 other or 10 other people living with me. The only thing we all had in common, we became friends over using drugs. Like, that's all we knew about each other for real.
That was my favorite thing about smoking weed.
Like, was the people?
The bonding, yeah.
Yes, 100%. No, there really was a communal sense of this. I people ask me all the time, because at the end there, I was also using a heavy amounts of cocaine. And they were like, but you didn't have a job. How did you afford this? And I was like, I traded my pills for it. You know, like, I had this, they had this. I was growing weed, I had weed. You know, it was like, we just were a communal group that was sharing all these different drugs. So it's lucky I didn't get into anything
very, like, holistic about that.
You know, if this was in Israel, we would have called this a kibbutz. I mean, exactly. It was just a very communal living, except around drugs. So I spend the night handcuffed to a bed at the hospital. I come to the next day, and I have a very distinct memory of reality sort of rushing back towards me, like from, I don't know, what was that movie with Jared Leto about heroin? The Requiem for a Dream, where it's just very much like, boom, and I'm back. And I literally look around, I'm in an intake center, I'm wearing a gown, and I go, where the fuck am I? That was my first words, like, what the fuck happened? And they tell me I survived a suicide attempt and an overdose. And I was now in this lockdown unit. How I got there, I have no idea, but I was there. And I spent 3 weeks there and then was released to my parents, who sent me to a long-term care facility, what we would have called a mental institution 50 years ago, up in the Berkshires, where I spent 3 months.
I mean, this sort of brings me back to Choose Your Struggle. It's you were fortunate enough to have parents who could afford this care, or insurance that could afford this care.
Oh, it was parents. And so we were, again, talking about this, my recent episode of my podcast, where I told a story about being at this place. I say on there, and this is true, this place was so expensive. It's thought of as the best, or at least at the time, 12 years ago, it was thought of as the best mental institution in the country. It was so expensive that people literally mortgage their houses to go there. There was a kid in there with me, you know, early 20s like me, who told everybody that his parents had got a second mortgage on their house just to send him there. This place was so expensive. And I think that was one of the reasons I hated it so much, was that it was so bad that if it had been just like a regular old lockdown unit, I would have been like, all right, I mean, this is just the shitty state of health in this country. But because it was so expensive, it was like, wow, I cannot believe how much this cost to be this terrible.
Right, right. And is this where the Wendy story occurred?
Yeah, so I check in there in the 1st of October in 2009. And I left on December 31st of 2009. And in between, I mean, it was pretty horrible. It was so bad that a couple years ago, I had a therapist diagnose me with PTSD because of this experience. And I was like, I don't know if I agree with that diagnosis. However, I think I just have forgotten a lot because of how many drugs. I mean, I was on so many drugs that I'm amazed I remember any of it. She was like, yeah, but also, can you recognize that, let's be honest here, you're probably repressing a lot. And I was like, yeah, maybe. I mean, that's definitely part of the story here. That there was so much, it was so horrible, and I was so unhappy there, that I've sort of just pushed it all down. But the Wendy story is sort of the short version. I had a very good friend there who came in 2 days after me. We were both from far away. We quickly bonded, became very, very close, inseparable. And about 2 months, 2.5 months into our stay, she did attempt suicide, and I stopped her. And what was so horrible about this is twofold. Number one, again, this place is supposed to be the best mental institution in the country. Multiple people had already committed suicide in my stay there, some of whom in a very graphic and traumatic way. Others, or the other half of the other trauma of this is that if I had not been so caring of her, if I had not been so aware, she would have slipped through the cracks and been the next person to complete a suicide attempt. And that was so upsetting to me that I literally the next day began the process to discharge, that I could not stay here anymore, because not only did I think that it's possible that I would be next, I hated it and was so hurt by being there, but also, if this place was so horrible, this just incredible person had been, you know, literally minutes and one person being me away from ending her life, with all these people not knowing, I just was like, I cannot be here if this place is this awful.
And so you got out and somehow you found your own.
Yeah. So that happened in the middle of, like, not long before Christmas. And essentially what happened was, I got some red flags from her, went to her room, ended up talking her out of it. She admitted that she was going to attempt suicide, and, you know, helped her report this attempt. She was sent to away to a lockdown unit, and, I then began checking myself out. I left on December 31st. Oh, actually before I checked myself out, this is a really important part of that story. The way that they used to do group therapy in these settings was literally the same as One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. If you've seen that in that movie where they all sit in a circle and just gang up on somebody, that happened. That was real. That was not made up. Even in 2009, we were still doing this. Now, I've been told by people that has been eradicated. I hope that's true.
It depends on who's leading the group.
It was pretty traumatic. And I am lucky that only happened to me once. And it was when you try to check yourself out, you have to go to one of these and be the center of attention. And I had made it, you know, almost 3 months at this point without being the center of attention. But that day you had over 100 people, I mean, hundreds of people, every patient there, every clinician, every therapist focused directly on me. And I, as I say in my recording that just dropped on my podcast today, one of them was the head psychologist for this entire institute, literally looking me in the eye. Here's a 50-year-old, 6-year-old woman telling me that I was an idiot, that I was throwing my life away. And there, this is the part I always choke up. There was my other best friend in there who skipped these groups. She literally protested. They finally said, fuck it. We're not going to make you come to them. This isn't worth our time. She came that day just to sit next to me and help me get through this. So, she was incredible. And I took it. I just sat there and let them all gang up on me. And then we're done. And I said, great, I'm leaving now. So I checked myself out.
Are you still in touch with her?
Unfortunately, she passed away a couple years ago. And I'm very lucky, and I say this on this recording, that even though we had lost touch, she knew how much she meant to me. She knew how much she meant to a lot of people at this place. I don't have that regret of, God damn it, I wish I could tell her, you know, because she knew. And we were all very vocal about how important this person was in our lives. Her name was Robin. And Robin Williams were my heroes.
Did Robin pass away of natural causes?
She did not, no.
Okay.
And I only found out because of Facebook. And it was there, you know, there is a Facebook page dedicated to her memory, and that's how I found out. So that was about 3 years ago now, 4 years ago now. And that was very, very upsetting when I found out. And obviously she lives on in all of us who cared about her very deeply.
And no regrets is kind of the best thing you can walk away with in that case.
Yeah, I am super lucky that was one of those situations where it's not like, God, I wish I had the moment to tell her, like, you know, but she knew, and that gives me peace. So I check myself out and I go live with the only person who will take me in, which is my grandmother. And my grandfather, but really it was my grandmother putting her foot down and saying, you know, basically she recognized I wanted to go through withdrawal. I wanted to get off all these drugs. And to do so, I went through what's called step down detox. And basically she recognized he's either going to do this here or he's going to do it on the street. He can come here. So I spent almost 4 months going through step down detox. And for those who don't know, that is the opposite of cold turkey, because cold turkey kills.
Yeah.
And it took me almost 4 months because I was on so many medications at such a high amount that, you know, instead of just going off it all at once, which would have killed me, I took a little bit less every couple of days, and it took me almost 4 months.
And so you did this yourself?
I had... there was a therapist that I was sent to in Arizona where I lived with my grandmother, who wanted me to stay on the pills. I said to her, ain't gonna happen. I was like, look, I literally just left this horrible place with this intention in mind. You have two options. Either I'm not gonna see you or you're gonna help me do this. And she said, okay, I'll help you do it. So, her only role in my life was to make sure I was doing it at a pace that was healthy.
Of course.
You know, that meant really just telling me, okay, you can probably speed it up a little bit. I mean, I was going so slow, because I was on so much, but it took me, you know, like I said, almost 4 months. I finally get off it. And that was the spring of 2010, in about late March, early April. And that was it. That was sort of my, I'm back at the starting line moment, but I truly believe, you know, unlike what movies would tell us, it's not like, you know, you walk out of rehab and like, yay, I'm good. You know, that's not real. It took me probably about 5 years to start feeling actually healthy again, for my age, my maturity, all of that to catch up with my actual body and what was going on inside of me, my brain to develop, all that kind of stuff.
Yeah. So
it was a long process.
But it's really happy, sad for me to hear of your success, you know, I mean, and it is a success. And, you know, I know you do talk a lot about in recovery without being sober. And I, you know, stopped your Twitter page earlier today. And I saw this funny thing about an old pipe and, you know,
yes,
lit the weed. And it's interesting the way some, they're like, I know people, like I have a friend who he same way, you know, like he knows what he can do, he knows what he can't. And then there's another person who has once said, like, listen, it's not the alcohol. It's that if I have the alcohol, I'll end up smoking the crack, you know? And so like different people, different ways. But for me, having watched a loved one go through a revolving door of comically bad, like, escapes or like, you know, break out all this shit, it's nice to hear. It doesn't happen immediately, but it's nice to hear that it happens.
Yeah. And you know, I so there's two parts of that. Number one, I think we're moving towards this more general understanding that people, a lot of people have had it for a long time, which is that recovery is a very personal thing.
Yeah.
It is not a one size fits all, that sort of some of the more social accepted treatment options would have you believe. It is very much a personal thing. For me, I never struggle with alcohol. And so this idea that I should give up drinking, but I'm okay to smoke cigarettes, like that didn't make sense to me.
Right.
And so, you know, I appreciate people who are willing to be open to that.
Yeah. I mean, and I'll tell you this, the problem that I often have with my patients is, so someone comes to me for anxiety, what are they doing? Well, they're smoking weed. And then if I, you know, send to a psychiatrist, if we decide that's the way to go, because obviously the weed's not covering it, the psychiatrist, I always kind of have to low key be like, just like limit, you know, like just tone it down for that conversation, because I'm not taking away your safety net, but I don't, like, a psychiatrist has to be like, well, you never know how it interacts with your medication. You know, like, I don't believe in that. I believe in don't fucking, the kid can't walk. You're going to cut off, you know, like cut off his arm. So he, so it's, I think there's still a bunch of, you know, misunderstandings about this. I mean, the first time I went to a psychiatrist for anxiety meds, it was probably, I was dealing with some postpartum shit, and I filled out, I honestly answered every question, one of which was about cannabis abuse. I was 31. I was like, well, I used to smoke a lot in college, and years later I had a car accident and my lawyer had me subpoena my records from the psychiatrist, and his initial diagnosis was rule out cannabis abuse. I was like, I called him on it, and then I was like, I'm never coming back. Like, you know, like it was 10 years later.
Right. Yeah. I think that there's, and again, you know, this is something I talk about a lot, because the way we still talk about drug use, it is 100% echoes of the war on drugs, in some cases literally still the war on drugs, that you can trace the roots of this to overt racism, but nobody really wants to talk about that. They want to go, okay, but that might have been true four generations ago, but now we all know that this is dangerous. And it's like, not actually, you know, that if you really look at the studies, no drug itself has a higher than roughly, I think it's meth has the highest rate of actual medical addiction, and it was about 16%. And that's not something that a lot of people can really cognitively process. They're like, no. But I learned that if you smoke crack, 80% of people are going to get addicted. That's not true.
80% of people are going to love it, maybe.
Right. To be clear, the rate of people who will struggle with misuse is higher. However, I literally just did a TED talk on this. The three most lethal or harmful, let's say that word, harmful substances are all legal in terms of people who struggle, percent of people who struggle, percent of other forms of harmful use. Those three are alcohol, nicotine, and sugar. And so if you're telling me that our laws are based on safety, I'm going to tell you you're wrong, and I'm going to point at that statistic. So let's try again. The fact is this, none of these are based on safety. They're all based on other forms of community control, most of which come directly from overt racism. So,
or covert. It's covert because we're not, you know, it's overt when you see it. It's covert when, you know, to the rest.
So here's the thing. It's only been covert since they started switching their language in about 1950. Before that, it's the same arguments, right? We see them recycled over and over and over again. But you're right, since roughly 1950, under Eisenhower, the arguments have gone from straight up overt racism to dog whistle racism.
Right.
Nixon, when he kicks off the war on drugs, everybody now knows this famous John Ehrlichman quote where he says, yeah, we made that shit up. We knew that if we couldn't make it illegal to be a hippie or be black, so to criminalize these communities, we associated them with these different drugs, and then we criminalized those drugs heavily. He says this stuff on his deathbed, and everybody's like, oh my God. And it's like, people knew this for decades.
Yeah.
So it is startling, and I want to preface that by saying that I'm not saying all drugs are safe. I am saying the dangers have been so vastly overrated we've been so lied to that most of what you hear is either intentionally or unintentionally wrong.
Interesting. Yeah, I mean, when I'm meeting with a teenager and their parents, I explain that the way I do HIPAA is this, like, you know, confidentiality. Like, you know, I give them the three things I would have to break it for: child abuse, homicide, or suicide. But I am a very careful assessor of suicide in terms of, you need to be able to tell me that you feel like killing yourself, and I need to be able to listen and sure. hear if it's real or if it's thoughts. Because if I send you to the fucking hospital every time you have a thought,
right,
you are going to kill yourself because it's depressing, you know? But I always tell parents, like, if your kid tells me they smoked a joint, I'm not telling you. If it tells me they had a beer at a party, I'm not telling you. If they tell me they had a six pack and got behind the wheel of a car, that's when I'm going to step in, because yeah. that's the danger, you know?
And I, you know, that's such an important point, because I have parents who have reached out to me. They'd be like, I think my kid's addicted. And, oh my God, you know, that's, must be very scary. Tell me why you think that. Well, I caught him smoking a joint. And right. okay. And they're like, well, but that's a problem. I mean, I'm not going to say it's good.
As a parent, maybe.
Right. I'm not going to say exactly.
Right. Well, remember, weed was when I don't know if we're close enough in age for this to be the, but weed was the gateway drug.
Yes. Yeah. So yes, we are close enough. I'm 35. However, that's not gone away. Our president said that as of a month ago. So now, to be fair, he is, what, 110?
Listen, but, leave him alone. He hasn't killed anyone yet. He hasn't raped anyone yet. He hasn't, like, I know what he is. It's just a cotton ball. Just, you know, Biden, you know, Obama, like, you remember all those memes of, like, you know, about Biden's an idiot and Obama, like, I still have those on my Facebook account somewhere. And, like, in a little while, when it's safer, we can all laugh again. But in this case, like, just, like, breathe a little, you know, like, yes, he's old, that's what he remembers, but, you know.
Well, except that, unfortunately, with Biden, it's not just what he remembers. I mean, as those of us who crusade for drug policy like to remind yeah. people, he wrote these laws. The right. reason some of this is so screwed up is not just, oh, those Republicans. Like, Biden wrote this law.
You're
and
right.
so that's yeah. why he is so reluctant to repeal it, because then it would be him admitting he was wrong, which he has not done on this. So,
which would be the greatest thing a human being can do, is admit that they made a mistake yes. and that they've changed their mind. So,
and he has not done that on this particular issue.
Listen, I hear you, but I'm just it's a lot easier not to be. I just am less angry now and less. I mean, the news is more boring. Saturday Night Live is probably going to go out of business because no, they've got nothing, you know. But, like, I don't know. Let's just watch him walk his dog in peace for just. I need a breather, you know. Like, I'm not against what you're fighting for. I'm just saying, I need you know, I need America not to be the joke of the world, which, or to be it for a different reason, whatever. I don't care. You know, but you raise up a lot of good points. Jay, where can we find you? I did listen to several episodes of Choose Your Struggle, and I did really enjoy them. And
thank you.
Like, I always listen for research purposes, but you are now added to my, you know, update thing. And later today, I will listen to the Wendy story and hope I don't cry, which I probably will. But we're going to, you know, put this in the show notes and all that stuff. But my show notes, blah, blah, blah. Tell us about where people can find you and get your merch and support you, all that stuff.
So a couple different ways. On social media, I am either Jay Schiffman or Choose Your Struggle and everything. You can search for it and find me there. And Jay Schiffman is J-A-Y-S-H-I-F-M-A-N. On my website is just jayschiffman.com, and there you can find everything from, you know, contacting me to information on how to you know, sponsor the podcast or bring me in to speak. And then the podcast is called Choose Your Struggle. It is on all the podcast platforms. I drop twice a week. Fridays is normally interviews, although as we've now both said, today is a special episode as we're recording this. I did drop the Wendy story on there. So Mondays is usually just me talking or interviewing somebody that is kind of off brand or whatever the case is. Those are a little more laid back and a little more fun. The interviews are always with somebody in or 90% of the time, mental health, substance misuse and recovery, or drug use and policy, they always have a mix of learned and lived. No offense to people who, you know, spent 60 years researching. Those people are amazing. Don't get me wrong. Their stories and their voices are being heard other places. My platform is really more for people who are not being focused on, which is mostly those with lived experience. So if that sounds interesting to you, definitely check it out. Search for Choose Your Struggle wherever you're listening to this right now.
Excellent.
Thanks for listening to the Neurotic Nourishment Podcast. If you like what you hear, please be sure to rate, review, subscribe, tell your friends, shout from rooftops, smoke signals, hot air balloons, whatever. I'll take any of it. And if you really like what you're listening, why don't you become a patron? Join our Patreon. Visit us at patreon.com/neuroticnourishment. Thanks.